If you haven't been listening along, I would encourage you to go back to section one of the Annals of Bonsai Art of Kimura. But if you're just diving in now, section two is going to be a deep dive into pages 60 through 91, exploring sort of the untold story of the trees from this pivotal book.
Okay, now new bonsai for the 21st century. Let's move to page 60, number one, Juniperus chinensis.
Yes.
Yeah, so what a beauty this thing is.
And this is a precumbens, which makes it particularly rare. And not rare, I mean, in Japan, precumbens are not highly thought of. And I love them. I love them. I understand why they're not highly thought of, because the notion of the technique and the craft to make it a bonsai is maybe less than a shimpaku somehow, because they basically sort of mound and kind of do their thing, which I guess like when I look at it, Itoigawa juniper, I don't really see, aesthetically I understand the difference, but I don't really see how Itoigawa foliage grafted onto a juniper is any different than precumbens. It naturally mounds, it gets dense, yeah. It's low maintenance. It's kind of like, well, the disregard for precumbens, I mean, if you're saying I don't like the juvenile foliage, okay, that's fine. That just becomes a visual preference and not necessarily like a, I mean, that's like, well, I don't like Rocky Mountain juniper. I don't like California juniper. I don't like Sierra juniper. So, okay, that's just a visual preference. But the sort of the low thought of precumbens, I've never understood. And this is a particularly spectacular one.
Oh, it's beautiful. I mean, for me, precumbens and junipers like this, I don't mind that it looks like, you know, maybe a juvenile foliage. I mean, it's about the silhouette here, right? It's about this tree's silhouette and how dense that foliage and how well defined these pads are. That these are dense, healthy pads, and look at that dead wood and the living vein. It's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the biggest takeaway that I have from this piece, I mean, it's really hard when you look at these pictures to figure out the exact motion that this tree made, unless sort of you really dial it in. But basically what he did with this tree was just took, he didn't, he, it looks like he changed the angle of the tree to the right. Is that what you see? Like he leaned it to the right?
Yeah, because you can see the deadwood, it seems a little bit lower. Yeah,
the root comes out.
He didn't lean it to the right.
Oh.
All he did was lean it to the front. It's inclined dramatically to the front, which lowered the appearance of the deadwood on the lower right. But notice the elongation of the gin in the upper portion. And here's how you really know that he just raised it to the front. Where the where there's a horizontal line in the very top of the tree before it drops down into the canopy, where the live vein and deadwood interact there.
Yep.
Notice how in the hero shot on page 61, there's no horizontal line anymore. He pulled out more movement. You see the gin elongated on the top, and you see the root in page 51 that exists at the base of the tree, the living root.
Page 61.
Yeah, page 61, I'm sorry. The living root that exists on the tree in 61, and it's not in the image on page 60. But that just simply came from pulling the tree forward, and it raised the live root up out of the soil. So it's a very, very simple shift.
And look at that Nabari. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great tree. And the pot, the container combination is amazing, because you do have strength, particularly with that living root being present in the base now. The base becomes quite prominent. And so you have
perfect pot for it.
You have a lot of angularity in the movement, so a rectangle is great, but it is still very soft.
Yeah, it's a taller tree. I mean, look at how tall and slightly, you know, slender the trunk is. So the rounded corners.
Yeah, the rounded corners soften it. I think the rounded corners actually work well with some of the more curvaceous movement in the tree. I think that's where you have the compatibility.
Okay.
The rectangle, because you have strength in the base.
Yep.
And then the rounded corners, because you've got more curvaceous movement. If it had a lot more angular movement, sharper corners would probably make sense.
Yep.
But it's a beautiful, beautiful container tree combination. I mean, it's stunning.
page 62, Pinus parf. How do you pronounce
Parviflora.
Parviflora.
Yeah. Yeah, and
what's a parviflora?
Japanese white pine.
White pine. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, 5-needle white pine. I mean, this is just your quintessential sort of aging of the tree via design. Branch elimination, creation of space, remnants of dead wood,
yep.
And increased asymmetry. This is making a tree look older. When you talk about age, more asymmetry with the random occurrences, fewer branches, remnants of those branches, and more negative space. All three of those things. Remnants, asymmetry, negative space are all quantifications of age. And yeah. So, I mean, he basically increased the age of this tree by a couple hundred years
yeah.
through his branch selection. And I have always said it, Mr. Kimura is the most valuable thing that Mr. Kimura, or the biggest dictation of his design genius came in his branch selection and branch elimination. Case in point right here. Case in point. And again, if you look at the stand that it's sitting on in page 63, it's that same
one.
Yeah.
Oh, and look at those vertical bars underneath the bamboo, the faux bamboo.
I've just seen that stand so much that I have a hard time appreciating it. It's pretty played out for me. But it's a beautiful white pine. It's a very standard white pine. I wouldn't think that this is a significantly valuable tree. This kind of work was everyday work for Mr. Kimura. And this was the funny thing about becoming his apprentice. You see these articles of this radical work, and I thought when I would go there, like, oh, this kind of work is just for photo shoots. Photo shoots were just documentation of everyday work.
Sure.
I mean, we were doing this every day,
yeah,
we were making these changes, and it's translated to Mirai. The repotting that we do would be monumental for a lot of people to undertake the repots that we undertake. But
yeah,
we'll do a handful of those a day, and we do that every day through the repotting season. It's just that is the level that he functioned at, and it's very impressive.
Yeah, this is a great example for taking people who don't know what to do with the tree. You know, they have this tree. They don't know how to take it to the next step. This tree is a good example, page 62 to 63, of how you can take that tree that you don't know what to do with, that might be a little bit boring, that you might be getting kind of sick of, and taking it to the next level.
Well, and I think this is a good point, because most people would be very happy with the tree on page 62.
Oh, absolutely.
It looks like a bonsai. Mm-hmm. They would be pumped on that.
Yeah.
And that's cool and okay, and there's nothing wrong with that. There is more to be gotten out of that tree. And when you look at the tree on page 62, what more can be gotten out of that tree is a greater indication of age, because it's becoming a triangle. It's very symmetrical,
yep.
Which makes it look young. Even though the tree has age, it looks young. It's just a dense triangle. In making that leap of wanting that and knowing that that's possible and knowing that that exists and wanting that increase in enhancement of age and sort of shedding that youthful form when a tree, because every tree will move back to this youthful form. The tree on page 63, if you just watered and took care of that tree well, it eventually would turn back into a triangle.
Yep.
It would turn back into a triangle, because that's the most photosynthetically efficient shape that an upright growing form can take to make sure that all branches carry the same load and it's capable of growing to be a big tree. Every tree will move back towards its youthful form if it has the resources.
Yep.
So it's just understanding that that exists and how you get it there. That's a big lesson to be taken from that tree.
Page 64, Thunbergiana.
Thunbergiana.
Thunbergiana. Wow, the hero shot on this.
Yeah.
Same thing you said. It's adding negative space, branch removal, and in this case, removing some height off this thing. Huh?
Well, I think this is a little bit different because when you look at the tree on page 64 at the top, that image, you have a skinny trunk, but you have a foliage mass that suggests this trunk is very big. There's too much foliage for the size of the trunk. So this isn't, although the reduction of it does increase its appearance of age, what the reduction in branch selection does more than that is it actually brings the proportion of the foliage down to what the trunk can physically bear.
Exactly.
And so this is just, this more than aging the tree, in my mind, this is a proportional control of the design to bring the what the story the branches are telling into the same story that the trunk is telling so that you have a cohesive unit or a cohesive theme to the design and the story that's being told. It's a wonderful execution of a thin trunk overly grown with branches. And you see this a lot. People wanting to have a foliar load on a tree that the details of the tree don't support visually. I mean, horticulturally, the tree is like, yo, I'm good.
Sure.
But visually
the trunk is slender.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's multiple ways that this tree could have been handled on 64. You could have, if there were more movement in the upper portion of the trunk, which I'm assuming you have this great movement in the first two-thirds of the trunk, I would be willing to bet he took off the upper 30% because it probably lacked quality movement. If it had quality movement, he could have extended the design and still reduced the branching, but had a longer design. If it lacked movement, he shortened it to where the best movement was and reduced the proportions of the branch to fit the trunk. So there's multiple ways you can handle that.
Sure.
This is the way he chose because of what he's seeing in the tree that we can't.
Yeah. And these trees are all, now we're in this section, which is we get two-page trees. We don't get the full depth of the process that he went through. Page 66 and 67, Chinensis. Holy mackerel, look at that transformation, huh?
Yeah, this is really beautiful work. This is not my favorite tree in the book, but I would say it's in the top three favorite trees in the book. I think the rhythm that the tree has in the hero shot on 67 is magnificent. But again, like, it's not, nothing that's being done here is nothing is a mystery. It's not like Mr. Kimura just manifested this tree on page 67. If you look at the tree on page 66, the trunk comes out of the soil relatively vertical.
Yeah.
Takes a 45-degree turn and is now horizontal.
Yep.
You keep moving along that horizontal, it takes another 45-degree turn and it goes vertical again. And so, wait, no, 90. I'm sorry, 90, not 45. So it comes out straight, you take a 90-degree turn, it goes horizontal, you take another 90-degree turn, it goes vertical. All he did, and not, this isn't to undermine the work, but this is to say this is within the realm of everybody's capacity if you understand these nuances of avoid perpendicular and parallel lines in your design. Case in point right here. This is fundamental bonsai styling. All he did was find the location and the planting angle where he was able to take advantage of the best base, the best line, improving upon not having perpendicular and parallel lines to the rim of the pot. And then he adjusted the branches to give that tree a symmetry. And I mean, that is within everybody's scope to be able to do that. This is really fundamentally solid bonsai practice.
Yeah.
And when I was looking at this book when I was a kid, it was just like, oh my gosh, Mr. Kribble, like, how did he see that in it? How did he know that? But his design process, and I think this, when I think about bonsai design and how you take any tree that sits on your turntable and make it the very best it can be, you're not just conjuring up images out of the blue. You're basing your approach on fundamental things that are in the visual language of bonsai. And so he's seeing these inconsistencies here in terms of the perpendicular and parallel lines, inconsistencies with quality, and he's making the changes to fix those while finding the best baseline and features of the tree. And then he's taking where the branches are and figuring out, how do I kick something out to give me asymmetrical flow? Where does my apex then originate from? And that is what created the tree that you see on page 67.
And, you know, tipping the tree forward towards the viewer to minimize that horizontal and vertical plane.
Well, so he rotated it. We're looking at the back of the tree.
We're looking at the back, but then he tipped it forward. And then you can see a thin guy wire where he compressed the foliar mass slightly towards the main trunk. You can just see that guy wire in there.
Oh, yeah.
You see that?
Oh, yeah. Good eye. Good eye. There's a lot of little tricks in there.
And this is a harmony tree, I think, right?
Yeah, harmony. Yeah, trunk moves to the left, defining branch moves to the left, and the apex moves to the left. And again, we looked at the dynamic design with the juniper that had the quote-unquote rotting base that really wasn't rotting.
Mm-hmm.
And the dynamic design with that rotation allowed for that, and also it increased the tree's quality with that dynamic design because it lacked something, right? With this tree, it has everything that you could ever want.
Yeah.
You don't need to use design to elevate the tree even further. It's already got it. It has everything that you need. Allowing this to be a harmonious tree where the trunk moves in to the left, the defining branch to the left, and the apex to the left, it's literally like taking the most passive approach to design and just saying, you got this. You don't need me to do anything more than just use what you have in the most sort of passive, agreeable way so that we can appreciate the magic that exists already.
Yeah. Awesome. Next page, 68 and 69, Taxus.
No. Oh, it is a Taxus. Excuse me. Sorry about that. I thought this was a hemlock for whatever reason.
Is a hemlock in a similar family as, or similar, it's not the same species, but it seems like it has similar foliage as a yew.
Yeah, I mean.
Or not, or they're.
Well, Taxus and Tsuga is hemlock. And I mean, I guess there's similarities to the sort of foliar layout, but then you could say, well, Doug Fir also has, to some degree, a similarity. And it's, I think where those similarities cross over is just management of the sort of the technique to manage the growth and direct the energy.
Yeah.
But other than that, I mean, they just have a similar foliar layout. I don't know how closely related they would be on the sort of family tree, but I would have to look into that to see.
Boy, that original pot seemed like it was chosen just to fit the roots.
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. And the success after collection, I mean, how often do you see that?
All the time.
Just, yeah, it is what it is, and then the tree makes adaptations, and you get the tree, and you recognize that root isn't alive or it's not significant, and then you go about the styling process. I think they showed the hero shot on page 69. That's from July, but then on page 68, that's July 24th, 1984, on page 69. But then they show it again in October, which is several months later in 1984, and you see the canopy is more dense. That lower branch that he dropped down is now elevated, and it's become a lot more planular tree.
Yeah.
I mean, huh. I don't know. This tree doesn't particularly appeal to me that much, but here's the thing about this is, you're looking at from May 3rd, 1984 as a raw tree to the first styling in July to October 1984. You're only looking May, May to June, June, July, July, August, August, September, September. You're looking at 5 months in the history of this tree. I guarantee you the version of this tree from October 1984 to even 1985, 1986, 1987, it probably gained a lot of quality. And there's merit to the front that he's chosen and stuff. It's almost too condensed of a time frame to really appreciate where this tree has probably gone in the design. And ultimately, when you first design a tree, you're taking what it has. You're trying to make the best with it and set really the focuses on the structure. Give the primary branches that are coming off of the trunk and the finality of the trunk line as it terminates in the apex, give those the best possible shape they can, and then you continue to build on the design from that point. So seeing this, it's not like I don't have much to say about good, bad, or indifferent about the design. What I would say is, I wonder what this tree looks like now.
Yeah.
You know, well, because the crook at the top and the return and the angle, the drama of the angle and stuff, it's all pretty rad.
It's nice, and it's got a nice twist in the trunk.
But as a Taxus, this is not an expensive Taxus.
Yeah,
it's a very I would say average, accessible piece of material. And in Mr. Kimura's Volume 1, Volume 2, and Volume 3, there's a lot of fantastic material that he does magic with. There's also a lot of humble material that he just maximizes it to the best of his ability. And that's
fun.
At that point, he didn't have a ton of money to be buying just extravagant material all the time. So he did really great work with really humble material.
Number 70, page 70, a chinensis. This is one of my least favorite trees in the book. I don't know why, other than the Nabari looks weird to me. In the finished shot.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think look at the starting material,
yeah,
first of all.
Yeah, you use what the tree gives you.
And I think that not enough time has elapsed, because this would be a completely different tree now.
Oh, yeah.
And I also think this is where carving can be as dangerous as it is beneficial in some regards, sure, and to some degree. And how do you handle that flaring base? I mean, that's how he chose to handle it. And, you know, I'm sure everybody has their opinions about it. I don't really have much to say about this. It is what it is. It's too early to say, like, oh, that's fantastic work or that's crappy work. Who knows?
I mean, if you were to elongate these foliar pads to the left, it helps to give a reason for that Nabari. So, you know,
yeah,
10-20 years of growth.
Well, I mean, he's just setting
probably great.
He's just setting the structure.
Yeah.
I mean, there's absolutely no version of this that has any indication of the final tree. I mean, when you stack on all the growth, it would be different in a single year. And that's one thing that we've learned at Mirai, is how I saw how trees were built in Japan with Mr. Kimura, but really, since coming back to Mirai and truly building trees from the ground up, that is the funnest part of bonsai, that process and journey, and learning how to do that well is the crux of bonsai.
Yeah. Page 72 and 73, a rigida.
Rigida needle juniper.
And this thing turns into an incredible tree. If you look at those top smaller photos, and okay, this one we get more depth into the technique on the next page.
Yeah, this tree is actually quite a famous tree. I've worked on this tree several times. It's called Hakute. Which I think they say in Heroes means like thunder god or something.
Is
like
this
that.
Thing pretty large? Huh?
Big, it's huge. Well, it says it's 29 inches here. It's considerably bigger when you see it in person now, with the sort of increase of ramification and age and why. I mean, it's a fully developed rigida now, and when this tree came in. And somebody said, oh, this is Hakute, and it's, you know, it was in one of his books. it's almost unrecognizable when you see it now compared to seeing it here. But the branch, so if you look at the hero shot on page 77 and you see the live vein just left of center of the trunk move to that smaller trunk and that branch, when it came into the garden, that had become massively enormous, and he hollowed out sort of the upper apical region of that significantly and then bent that back towards the front and reduced it to bring it back into proportion. And so even on the designs that he's creating over the course of time, you have to continue. Bonsai is not something that you can just stop the process of.
You can't freeze it.
You can't freeze it. And there's always ways. He was always adjusting his own work each time it came in. And that's really where each time you touch a tree, you're not just maintaining it. You should be making it better.
Yeah.
And if a tree, if you're touching it and just maintaining it and it's not becoming better, then either you've taken that tree. I mean, there's also the concept of age and getting that mochikomi on a tree and stuff. And I'm into that, but that's still improving. There comes a point where a tree has all the age, has everything, and you're just sort of holding it there, sort of doing the maintenance on it. That's a real lull in the bonsai process. And that might mean, not saying that somebody should just go and restyle that tree just to restyle it because it has, but you are at a point of stagnation with that tree. And yeah. I wonder, one thing that I've started to think about is I wonder if that's when your time with that tree is kind of finished.
Yep. Yeah, start getting bored of a tree after a while.
Well, and if you're getting bored of it, it just means that you're not thinking creatively about the design and analyzing the qualities of the tree. But there comes a point where you've, from what you identify as the best qualities of that tree, you've brought it to that fruition, and you're sort of out of ideas.
Yeah.
And that probably is a point where the relationship needs to part ways.
Or you bring it here and have you put fresh eyes on it, or I take it to Todd and have him put fresh eyes on it, or I take it to just a club workshop or Wednesdays in my garage with the boys. Get some different perspectives. Sure, and get different perspectives. And yeah, it's amazing sometimes what other people see when they put fresh eyes on
it's
a
true.
Tree.
Yeah, it's very true.
Man, it's like I have trees that I'm just bored of, and I actually sit down with them and start cleaning them and reacquainting myself. And boy, is it easy to get re-excited about a tree, you know? So
boredom with a tree is the instinct. It is the sensation that says this tree needs input.
Yeah.
Because if you're bored of it, what I call it falling out of love.
Yep.
If I've fallen out of love with a tree, it means that it's time to reinvest.
Yeah.
Not because it's like I need to be in love with every tree, but you should be captivated in my mind by every tree that you have. And if you're not, if you purchase material with an educated mind to purchase material that has merit, and you stop seeing the value in that tree, it just means it's time to re-up and bring out the value again. And that's just the evolution of design. Every time that I fall out of love with a tree and I find myself sort of not interested in working on it, I kind of look at it and I'm just kind of like, meh. Just means it's time to invest energy in that tree.
Because there's a reason you worked on it in the first
place.
There's
a reason I bought it in the first place.
Yep.
There's a reason I found value in it. There's a reason that I got excited enough to do the work to begin with. So it's only going to get better if you were excited and did good work in the beginning. It's only going to get better. A lot of times what happens is all of that growth in the tree changing the direction. You give a tree input, it responds to that input, it gives you input, you respond to that input. This is the dialogue of bonsai. Yep. But sometimes the tree's direction goes back towards some sort of more symmetrical, younger looking, maybe overly dense, sort of boring form, and you've got to come back in and push it again in another direction. So it's just part of the conversation.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's keep moving because we still got a lot to go through.
You wanted to go deep, man.
I know,
man.
I know.
I told you, each one
how
of
are
these.
How you doing, Lime? You're doing good?
I'm doing good.
Okay.
How are you doing?
Good, good. I just wanted to check on time. I know we are going.
Yeah, when do you
deep.
Need to get out of here, Lim?
Whenever, you know, when we get done.
Okay.
I mean, it's really important that we're going deep on these trees. This is really useful to do this, I think, through this book. So
there's so much to be learned just from looking at really good work. And it doesn't have to be Mr. Kramer's work. I mean, we could look at so many books.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's looking at bonsai, critically looking at bonsai, not critical for like, we're not sitting here talking about how this is garbage.
Yeah.
Critically looking at bonsai means looking at it in depth, really, yep. really breaking it down, really understanding the design decisions. And obviously because I understand, because I apprenticed with Mr. Kramer and I have a little bit of an insight. I would never say I understand Mr. Kramer, but I have an insight into some of the reasons why he might have made those decisions, or sort of the design nuances he applied. It's really interesting to go through it and just tease those out.
So this 78 to 79, look at the pot on 78 to 79. What I mean, even if you didn't do anything to this tree and simply put it into the new pot on 79, what a difference, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, but I mean, he used the left side of the tree. There's like a really weird transition of taper in the material. This was probably very affordable material.
Yeah.
And he took a diamond in the rough, essentially.
Yeah.
And gave it a lot of asymmetry, and the container selection, cool, but also the detail in the trunk that existed, cool.
Oh yeah, look at that.
Yeah. Yeah, this is great work. Container selection is spectacular for this one though.
Yeah. Yeah. And another white pine. Nice bark. When do you see the bottom gin?
Mm-hmm.
When do you decide to leave bark on versus take it off? Like, this thing's kind of halfway ginned.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like it probably still has sap flow, because it looks like there's a gin sticking out of a calloused area.
Okay.
So it created an area of interest, and if you take that off, it's just a ramrod straight gin. It probably loses its value entirely. Sure. I don't know. It's a decision that he made. There's continuity there. There's probably still life in it. If it were dead, it would be different, but it doesn't look to me. There's probably still sap flow moving through that, mm-hmm. whatever vascular redirection that occurred. And I'm not in a super rush to get the bark off of a pine, because if you kill off a branch and you sort of break down the tip of the branch while it's still very sinuous and expose some of the interior tissue and give justification and not just leave it as a stump and leave the bark attached to the rest of it, over the course of 2 or 3 years, it'll dry up and the bark will naturally fall off. And then you don't destroy all of that, that wood surface underneath that bark with tool marks.
Yeah.
And that's really valuable, because pines definitely have a cylindrical form to their deadwood. They don't have the grain exposure that a juniper does, like a Rocky Mountain that's been blasted with a lot of wind and eroding rock that essentially sandblasts the deadwood. So you have to handle the deadwood specific to the species, and pine in general has a cylindrical deadwood to their gin. And that's the way that I choose to handle it. I'm not a big proponent of going in and marring up the wood just to get the bark off. I think that's silly. Yeah. Wait, let it naturally weather and deteriorate, dry up and come off on its own, and you get far superior deadwood that way.
Okay.
Yeah. But you always do need to break down the cut. That's important too. You got to break down the cut.
It. Yep. Next page, 80 and 81. Wow, what a dramatic tree. The verticality of it. Putting it in the center of this pot is, to me,
it's a round pot. So like just a ramrod upright tree, apex inside the lateral boundary in a round pot. This is taking a rough piece of material and sort of doing something sculpturally creative. I mean, beyond that, there's really not much to discuss there.
I love the dead wood though. These big blades going up and down. Really awesome. I wonder what this tree looks like, 10 years from now, or 10 years from when this picture was taken.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I don't know. I've never seen this tree. Yeah. So, but I mean, look at the material that he started with. It is
huge.
What it is. I'm not a huge fan of anything. But it's a creative solution.
Yeah. Yeah, really. Next page. 82. Chinensis. I love this. What he found with this angle change.
Mm.
And choosing the front where... Perfect example of maximizing the drama mm-hmm. that you talk about when we look at these trees. We're trying to find the angle and side showing the maximum amount of drama and mm-hmm. that this is that.
Yeah, that fold is powerful. The interaction of the live vein along that bottom rim of that fold is pretty radical.
Looks like a bird because with the gins going off to the right, looks like a wing, and just almost to me looks very very bird-like here.
Look at the in the picture on 82, the raw tree. Look at how long and leggy the foliage is.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the funny thing about coming back and looking at these junipers in the even this we're talking about the 80s right now, is their junipers' foliar quality was not stellar.
Yeah,
I mean, a lot of the Toyogawa grafted stuff is a recent trend and a recent fad, and I appreciate the different foliar types that you're seeing in the junipers in this book. Compared to the monoculture of Itoyagawa grafted and everything, I don't understand why that has happened, but I definitely disagree with it because I think variety is the spice of life,
mm-hmm.
and it's market driven and it's trend driven, and I find it to be quite uninteresting personally, and I think it's a shame that it's starting to permeate. Bonsai outside of, although there are a lot of people that stay true to the native foliage, and we graft sometimes too, so it's not like we're
sure,
it's not like we're like, no, never graft, like if it improves the tree, cool.
Yeah,
but there's also a lot of value in the native foliage, and to think of just grafting everything over it seems silly to me.
You know, the tree on the left page is not bad, it's awesome, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I love it, but to change, to make this change, it's really, he took it to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on. Page 84, Ataxis.
Yeah, now that we're here, I just want to go back to the tree on 6869.
Okay.
Not to talk about it any further, but just to confirm that it's mischaracter, it's miscalculated. This, without a doubt, is not a Taxus on page 68 and 69. It's not a Taxus. It's absolutely a hemlock, which is called Kamitsuga. And when you look at the bark, Taxus doesn't produce bark like that.
Okay.
And Taxus, the foliage of this, the bark characteristics, the deadwood characteristics, none of that is Taxus. So then coming back to page 8045, mm-hmm. this is also absolutely Kamitsuga, okay. which is the Japanese hemlock. And when you see just sort of all of the different characteristics that exist in this tree, I find this tree to be quite magical.
Mm-hmm.
And when I used to look at this as a kid, I was like, how, when you look at the raw tree on page 84, how would you ever conceptualize rearranging the structure of that really rudimentary branch system where all of it comes from sort of one portion of that into this complex branching on page 85? That organization of that and that conceptualization, like how do you know which branch is the apex, how do you know which branch goes here and how do you know which branch goes there, that mystified me. This in my mind is super complex to try and wrap your mind around and figure out, not how he did it, because it's clear, okay, he bent that branch up and he sort of wired all of those out, but how did he make those decisions to do that?
Yeah.
And ultimately this scenario is where you would see 100 different people handle it 100 different ways, because the branching pattern here is wide open to interpretation.
Yep.
And this is where you choose which one of these is going to be your defining branch, which one is going to be the apical region, what movement do you put into that to put that branch that's going to be your apex at the top of your design, and where do you carry out the length, where do you prune to reduce the length, where do you push, where do you pull in the design. And what it looks like to me is that he's created a trunk that's moving leftward, if we look at the hero on 85, mm-hmm. a trunk that's clearly moving left, a defining branch that clearly is all the way out on the far left, but an apex now that, again, when you see him extend the length of the apex back to the right,
yeah,
he's sort of pulling the apex back to the right. It's a little bit underdeveloped, but he's shortened on the left, he's elongated on the right. It's a little underdeveloped to see his total intention, but it looks to me like this is very much a dynamic design in the making. I could be wrong. Maybe it was harmonious. Who knows? But I like the dynamic design concept for this tree and everything that it's offering. And I find this to be quite nice to look at. And I think that in two more years, it would have 30% fewer branches as the important branches fill out structurally and thicken. He's going to be pulling out. So if you look right smack dab in the center of the foliar mass, you see the major structural branches have raphia on them.
Yep.
And literally right smack dab bullseye in the middle, there's a squiggly branch that drops straight down mm-hmm. and then curves over to the right and then makes a curly Q back to the left. Those are the types of branches that are in here to add foliage mass and use that foliage mass to give the tree strength and help the design evolve. That's the first branch to go.
Yep.
When you go back in and you start reducing unnecessary branches, it's used for the purpose of horticultural reasons and to fill out the design aesthetically. You know, and you could say, well, just cut it off if it's not a branch that exists. But leaving that branch allows the other branches that are definitively going to exist to grow faster and stronger because the foliage mass attached to that is photosynthesizing and contributing sugars and starches to the system. And maybe it fills a spot in the design that as this tree fills out in other areas is no longer necessary.
Sure.
And so you take it off.
It's a sacrifice branch.
It's a branch that contributes to the initial concept,
uh-huh.
but doesn't exist in the even the second iteration of this concept.
To me, the foliage on the right side of the triangle seems a little bit like he was trying to make sure that the foliar mass of the tree was connected to the trunk. I feel like a lot of people, especially nowadays, would have taken all the far right pad off, the pad below it and to the left off, and possibly the pad below it and to the left of that off. Those three pads, I feel like in some of these modern designs today, would be gone and the entire tree would be moving to the left.
I mean, I think that would be the most asymmetrical commitment, but I don't think...
Yeah.
So number one, typically in Japanese bonsai design, the design is using the foliage mass to yeah. bring stability to the tree instead of putting a lot of the visual weight on the base or the presence of the live vein and stuff like that. And that's where when you look at ancient trees, you recognize that to push that far degree of insinuation of age and asymmetry in the randomness of the foliage mass, you maybe would make a total commitment to take off the branch on the right and forego the counterbalance of the foliage to lean on the characteristics of the trunk, which this tree has every single bit of stability you need
yeah.
to be able to push to the left. But I think it's different. I think yeah. the reason that there is the same length on the left longest branch as there is on the right longest branch is because it's the first iteration of the tree, and how could mm-hmm. you know
yeah.
which direction to go? Generally, generally in a first styling of a tree, you will have some degree of uncertainty and you will have sure. some degree of symmetry in the design. I mean, this has happened on Mirai Live several times where it's like, hey, we're going to have to pick, take the field-grown Japanese black pine. I mean, both sides
yeah.
of that tree, it's sitting out on the bench out there. They're all both super long. It's like, well, we could go to the left, we could go to the right, we could do this, we could do that. You don't know which branch is going to behave in which way back bud and strengthen and ramify and which direction the apex is going to, you just don't know enough to make those commitments in the first styling on a Yamadori tree or a raw field grown tree. If you're restyling a tree that's established, those are the decisions that you make.
Yeah.
But
you stew on it a little bit.
No. You give the tree the opportunity to take your initial feedback and then start to guide the process as well. This is letting the tree carry some of the weight. So for Mr. Kimura to just shave it all off and be like tight and sort of make that commitment in such a raw phase, horticulturally it doesn't make sense because you're decreasing the photosynthetic system that allows it to develop. Design-wise, it doesn't really make sense because it's not mature enough to make those kinds of reductions and decisions. And third, if you just want to look at it, where the branch on the right is placed, it's placed right in front of the trunk. I'm guessing you have inverse taper right there where there's that conglomeration of deadwood. You can see that it's kind of thick. It looks like it's covering something.
Yeah.
He's using that branch to disguise a little bit of a design flaw. Maybe it'll be shorter once it gets denser, but there's also those considerations as well. So you're talking about, just inside of analyzing this, you're talking about a lot of dynamics of understanding the developmental process, a lot of dynamics around the cultural approach to design. You're talking about a lot of dynamics around the horticultural approach to building a tree, and all of it is hypothetical why that exists, but you can see reasons in each of those, the cultural approach, the horticultural approach, and the design approach as to why those that commitment has not been made.
Yeah. Makes sense. Wow. This is so great to be going through this with you. I mean... My knowledge has been increasing just in the past hour. I feel like I've attained the next level.
Oh, this is your idea, man. I mean,
this is great.
I think over the course of time, 10 years at Mirai post apprenticeship. You become a lot more comfortable looking at things and not making judgment. I've become a lot more comfortable looking at things and not making judgments.
Yeah.
And just thinking about, well, what were they trying to accomplish? And also these things factor into sort of this scenario, and it could be any one of these things or all of them or maybe none of them. I would say there's probably a strong case to be made that at least one of those is true, if not two of them, or if not all of them. But yeah, but not judging it. It's just like, okay, that is that. And you can learn from all of those pieces and then, you know, take your preference and apply it to your own bonsai work. It's just, it's such a beautiful thing to be free of the judgment of what is right or wrong, good or bad. And just be like, oh, okay, that's how they did that. Cool. Okay. All right. And that's
it.
It's
how you approach it. It's the approach.
Objectivity.
Yeah.
Objectivity gives you, seems to me, objective approach to design gives you the best possible result. And that means leaving out a lot of judgment. Obviously, there are designs that are not appealing or designs that could be improved. Well, objectively, how do you do that then becomes the next conversation in my mind. Mm-hmm.
86.
Yeah.
Page 86.
Yeah.
Branch selection. Increasing negative space.
Yep.
Opening up the show me. I want to look this thing in the eyes, right?
Yeah.
You want to see this tree.
Remnants of what were negative space. Notice how he handles the length, particularly on the left side. You move out. From the apex moving down, you move out. You come back into a foreground branch. You move back out again. You come back in, and it's in the shadow a little bit. This is still in the upper 40% of the tree. You go out to the longest point in that upper canopy, and you come back in. And in the back, it's very dark, but there's a depth branch there. Mm-hmm. So you go out. You come back into the depth branch, which gives the design depth. You move out to the second longest branch on the left. You come back into a foreground branch. Now you're playing foreground, background, and then you go back out again. I'm assuming in the evolved design of this tree, and I don't know what this tree looks like now, the lowest left branch is probably not the longest branch. Particularly with Rigida, you start to get shorter branches on the bottom and longer branches up in the upper canopy for a tree to actually maintain a lot of interest. And this is styled as like a very young sort of formal upright.
Mm-hmm.
But I bet this tree looks very different today. But that use of length and the length going long, and then when it pulls back in, it pulls back into a branch in the back of the tree, is exactly how you create depth and that movement in the silhouette that gives an upright tree interest.
And I love the subtle curves in this trunk as you're following it up. You see that sort of main vein.
Mm-hmm.
Just some nice back, just left and right movement, and then these hollows are really cool.
Yeah, and I'm assuming that this pot was not the pot that Mr. Kimura chose. I mean, this is just a pruning and a wiring probably in one day. Maybe probably didn't even take him a full day to do this, right?
Yeah.
But you can see it came in that pot, and it's still in that pot. This rectangular container, cool rectangle for a formal upright. The cloud feet for a formal upright. Definitely not.
Oh, yeah?
No.
Okay.
Looks terrible. I mean, you have this formal upright verticality. Typically, you would go wider and shallower. Maybe the root system doesn't allow that, so you could stay in that rectangle. But definitely more contact with the surface of the stand and a lower seating, so there's not so much elevation under
lower
the pot.
Lower profile for foot.
For
yeah.
a tree that's already vertically tall, to then elevate the container
yeah.
with a height of a foot and show a lot of negative space, doesn't visually work, and it doesn't make any sense. But again, I don't think this picture is a discussion of the container selection, because you're just seeing the transformation from a overgrown bush to branch selection that gave the tree a lot more age. That's the purpose of this, I think.
Okay. Page 88, 89.
Lime, what do you think about this? Are you enjoying this?
Yeah, I'm learning a lot. I mean,
he's got to read his book backwards, unfortunately.
Well, I can't read it, but I can look at the pictures. I look good, but no, I'm just getting a lot of ideas.
Cool.
Yeah, it's more of where I'm just sucking in what you're saying and
cool.
listening to the dialogue, and yeah.
Cool.
Okay, so this is the tree that you guys talked about in the initial podcast, I think.
No, it's not.
It's not?
No, it's not. It's not. I mean, I think this is a beautiful move when you look at on page 88, the upper left image. I think this is a beautiful move from a tree that is basically symmetrical. The length of the branch on the left and the length of the branch on the right form a real triangular form. And it's very it's very youthful in that, in the symmetry, and it's also very pine-shaped,
yeah.
sort of like left-right back branch kind of style to the juniper, and that's not a juniper.
Yeah.
It's not really what makes a juniper. Where he goes with this, where he creates a definitive move, and this is, now we're talking about, if we look at the hero shot on page
91,
okay, well, actually, let's look at the shot on the upper left and page 90, and you still have length in the branch on the left side.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is in 1984. The front was changed further from that. 1982, it was restyled. 1984, it was changed again. And then you start to look at June 25th, 1984, still on page 90, but the lower left image, and he's removed that branch on the left and yep. made a definitive commitment to the asymmetry.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have an increase of deadwood, but you have that definitive commitment to the asymmetry. And notice on page 91, the hero shot, when you see it kind of filled out from that commitment, the presence of the live vein is on the left side of the trunk, and he removed the branch from the left side of the trunk to push the length and asymmetry to the right. So yeah. you have the live vein on the left side anchoring visually the push of asymmetry to the right. Mm-hmm. So it's supporting that removal of that branch, and it's justifying the elongation of the design to the right side by the live vein being on the left side to stabilize that visually. That's important for junipers. That's a major indication. There's nabari on the left side. There's some strong roots, and the live vein is on the left side. And that's what enables him to do this and have it hold mm-hmm. visual integrity.
Yep. He's also compressed the left side with a guy wire, if you look closely.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been brought in to close down negative yeah. space. Yeah. This is pretty cool from where it started to where it is. I mean, it is a pretty cool dialogue about sort of what makes a juniper interesting and what makes a juniper a juniper. Now, if we go back to page 90 again, lower left image, because mm-hmm. on page 91 against the black, it starts to blow out things. Black is not a very good for photography. It's not an awesome backdrop.
Mm-hmm.
You see the gradation on page 90 lower left. Imagine this. If you look at the right side of the tree, notice where the gin at the top swoops down and you have this branch that makes this arc and comes back up to kind of the highest pad on the right side of the trunk.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, imagine that as the apex and just cover up with your thumb the foliage on the left side of the trunk.
Mm-hmm.
You could push nice. That. You could push that far asymmetrically, add a lot of deadwood to the left side of the trunk, and have that be a very interesting, even fuller commitment to the asymmetrical movement to the right. Here's why, and you've always got to think, why would he not do that, okay? When you look at the position of the live vein and the portion of the live vein on the left side that is intact, my assumption, just based on where you see the live vein twist up the midsection of the tree, we're still lower left image on page 90.
Mm-hmm.
At the midpoint of the trunk, you see the live vein return on the right side of the trunk.
Yep.
And it moves up. I'm guessing the portion of the live vein that comes to the lower left base of the tree is connected to the apex that he currently has chosen. And that's why he couldn't push the design further asymmetrically to the right. That's why he's chosen to do this. That's my assumption. Because otherwise, it would be even more dramatic if you removed the apex. It's a little bit awkward, the apex up in that arc at the top of the tree.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing that as deadwood would be far superior with the tree fully committed to the right based on the presence of the live vein. The only reason he wouldn't do that, this is my hypothesis, and again, I'm not Mr. Kimura, and I don't know why, but my hypothesis is that live vein is still connected. And this, too, is huge for juniper design, to be analytical of these things. Because if somebody looked at this and they're like, I think it'd be better, he should just cut off the foliage on the left. It's like, that is the most... That's like skipping a rock across a pond. There is no depth to that analysis of the design
yeah.
when you come to this kind of complexity. And somebody who is creating bonsai on this level and intelligent enough to analyze that, there's a reason that he's doing what he's doing.
If you... Yeah, I'm trying to understand the structure of the top of the tree. You know, it's hard because it's a book.
It's impossible. But these are all when you look at designs and you think about a high level consideration of the why behind the design. These are some of the hypothetical things that, looking at it, these are what I'm analyzing and thinking about myself when I look at trees now.
If you go to page 88, bottom left corner, you can see more of a silhouette shot of what the top upper structure of the tree looks like.
Yeah.
And it, the branch moving to the right seems definitely differentiated than the branch moving to the left and forming that big, sort of rainbow apex, piece of wood. I don't know. It's.
Yeah, for sure. It's a complex so
maybe,
tree, man.
Yeah. Maybe you could cut it. I don't know.
It's a pretty complex tree.
Yeah.
This is one of those transformations that happened, and it's it's tough to follow because it's been changed so many times.
Very cool.
I actually have to be honest with you. I've never intentionally looked at that very much because I have, just over the course of looking at this book, I was always kind of like, eh. And then looking at it this time, that sort of... closely, it brought a lot more context out for me.
Yeah.